Welcome to The Lowdown, KMXT's show dedicated to giving you the up-to-date information we have available on the COVID-19 outbreak and how it's impacting life on Kodiak Island. The Lowdown will focus on facts as provided to us by local and state officials. During this edition of the show, we give you access to local physicians and public health experts with information on COVID-19 and recommendations related to it. If you have a question for our guests, please email it to lowdown@kmxt.org or call KMXT at 486-3181.
Let me just delve into something that I don't think we've ever talked about before, and that is the restrictions on you as medical professionals in regards to privacy and how you deal with transmitting data to the public so that the public is more aware, but you're not overstepping your bounds of interfering with, you know, that patient-client relationship and the federal regulations that monitor how you deliver information. I mean, I know the public really wants to know a lot of details that you're sort of prohibited from giving, right?
That's really true. Yeah, we can't really say anything. We just follow what the state says, and we'd say if it's travel related or not, if it's a resident or not, if it looks like it's community transmission or not. And pretty much, you know, we might, and then kind of we like to add in whether they're actually in on the island or not. But that's pretty much all we can say. We can't really give any other details.
It's always, you know, privacy in a small community is always a challenge. It's always a little bit more challenging, but especially in a time like this, I think it's even more so because there is such public interest in it. And I would say that, you know, from our perspective as medical providers is that we usually report these cases, like when we get back and they're positive, we report these cases to public health. And then we have worked really hard with ELSA and the public health department so that we are the ones that are communicating the initial result back to that patient if it was a test from our clinic, so that we can at least be the ones that convey that information first. And then we usually communicate with that patient, like that public health will be giving you a call, talking to you, you know, more about kind of what instructions they would have for you. But yeah, it's kind of an interesting role to be, like, typically if someone tests positive for, you know, influenza, we're, you know, I'm not reporting it to public health and doing all these things. So it's a little bit different, you know, of a thing.
Well, there are certain diseases, certain conditions reportable to the state, measles, anthrax. I mean, there are some STDs that are reportable to the state because we do follow them up and keep track. But again, we really try to respect people's privacy. And we don't in Kodiak, you know, we've had several times when we've just said, you know, there's a case in the borough, because anytime it's in a place that's smaller than 1,000 people, we don't even want to identify a community. And that's kind of across the state, unless, you know, the community itself pops up or that person pops up and says, you know, that they're, I know I think our very first case, they came right on Facebook right after. You know? Yeah. And so I was like, oh, there went all of our, so careful. But so it is kind of a touchy back and forth.
Well, how do you, like, navigate that to protect the public and at the same time protect the client? I mean,
well, in most epidemics, like when we are having a syphilis outbreak, you know, we don't even really, the news doesn't really care so much, you know, and so it's just COVID's really kind of a different beast all the way around.
Have we had a syphilis outbreak?
Oh, there's a big one up in the mainland. Yeah.
So, really?
Yeah.
So that's not getting as much press, apparently.
Yes. So, question from AFT is, so when you're doing contact tracing and you're kind of having to get involved with people all around this person, how do you probably have to step a little bit lightly, but people are going to be wondering what's going on. So how do you approach it from a public health perspective of trying to do the contact tracing?
So when we do call, you know, a lot of times it's family and they know, which makes it easier. But when it's not, when it's people that they've just been around, it's a matter of, you know, we can call somebody and say, you know, we have information that you've been exposed to somebody who has X, Y, and Z. And, you know, that's all we can say to them. And then tell them what we think we would like, how they would like them to follow up. But we never tell them who or where or what it might be.
Similar to STI testing.
Oh, thank you.
Or when you have an STI contact, you just call them up and say, you are identified as a potential
right.
contact.
Right.
Would you like to be tested?
Exactly. And you know, that's, yeah, exactly. It's that kind of thing. So we try to be really circumspect about who it is and where it came from, and try to be really careful. You know, we offer that always to people when we see them for that, you know, especially a lot of times we encourage people to talk to their contacts first, you know, so that right. they know that. And especially now in this state, a lot of asymptomatic people, there's so much going on that they're kind of like, talk to your contacts, tell them they should quarantine, you know, watch for symptoms, that kind of stuff. And they're not even doing as thorough an investigation with some asymptomatic people as with people that are really sick. So it's kind of a whole adventure.
So from the community perspective, when the word community transmission comes out, you know, there seems to be more of an interest in those type of cases of, if there is community transmission, where did it come from, and how do I protect myself from that happening to me?
Well, exactly. And we've had several cases during this you know, epidemic so far that have been community transmission, and luckily we haven't seen a lot of spread through that. You know, it's just we've had several cases that have popped up where they didn't recently travel. There was nothing that we can specifically say they were in contact with somebody that we know of that had COVID. So we know that it's out there. You know, we do. And so again, what are we, you know, we're always talking about our masks and standing back, our social distancing, and just taking care of yourself. I mean, really, that's still really in effect. And this shows exactly why.
Are we just getting lucky?
I think we've been really lucky. And our cases that we've had, you know, people have been pretty good about getting tested, and we've been able to, you know, have done a really good job isolating and doing their quarantine and staying away from people. So that makes a big difference.
So what is happening now in the state? Are there new trends throughout the state that have you, you know, are there new mandates that are coming out that people need to be aware of? Are there new trends in the state that we are positive for you or a negative for you?
Well, I think that you can see the one trend is the numbers are kind of coming down. And I think a lot of that is attributed to the shutdown of Anchorage for those, you know, that period of time. They shut down for several weeks and shut their bars and restaurants again, a kind of reset. And that seems to have made a difference, because we went from a couple hundred people a day down to now 50 or fewer, you know. So that's a big thing. I think our biggest jump we've seen is like young people going back to college and doing parties, going to a bunch of parties and having a good time, and it's spreading throughout those groups. We're seeing, you know, quite a bit of that. And unfortunately, there's been a couple cases that have gotten into our Pioneer Home and like McLaughlin Youth Center and a couple of our institutions, some of the corrections.
The biggest thing I think that's in all of our minds is just that as schools open, right? Like that, you know, that's probably the biggest thing that's going to be interesting to see. Sort of, it seems like almost inevitable that we're going to see, you're going to see these outbreaks in different spots. And I know that Shanna's mentioned this, and I think it's one thing, like they talk about these brush fires, right? You know, so like how effectively are we going to put out these small brush fires and keep them from becoming these raging forest fires throughout the state? And so, you know, again, we talk about the few cases here we have in Kodiak, you know, these community spread cases, like, you know, just really important to take care of them when they're small before they get out of control. Because then once they get out of control, then you're really forced to either just let them burn, which is, you know, or you can, then you have to do a more dramatic shutdown like Anchorage had to do. So
I think the overall trend nationwide, and then the state will probably follow, is, you know, we saw the big wave, everybody locked down, we contained that kind of forest fire, so to speak, about maybe 60 to 70%. It took a while, people became fatigued, and we kind of opened back up again with 4th of July, Memorial Day, and then we saw the cases spike again. People kind of went back into shutdown mode, more or less, across the nation. And then we're seeing the overall trend flatten. But as schools open up again, most epidemiologists expect that another wave will surge, and that will probably happen across the state too. The more intermingling we have of people, the more likely the virus is to spread around, and schools are going to be one of the big hotspots, I think. So, and that's happening in the lower 48 now. I'm sure Alaska will follow more or less
the UAF. And then I think Wasilla just had a couple schools closed down for a few days, because even though they just started up, they had an outbreak in the schools.
So. Seems to be coming from the sports teams as well throughout the state, as well.
The ones that were yesterday were in the school, right? Not so much.
In the school, and they were kids. They were like third graders and, you know, elementary kids. Those that I saw, I think maybe middle school, I'm not sure, but those were younger kids. There was an outbreak. There was a football team that had a case, I think, up in Fairbanks. But I don't think that's the greatest bunch of people. It's more like, hey, we're all back at college. Let's go have a great party downtown. You know,
the parties are going to be the big, a lot of the cases that have been tracked have been related more to the parties and the social interactions outside of the classroom.
I want to put your sleuthing hat on for just a second and try and figure out with me how the infection got into the Pioneer homes.
Oh, I'm sure it was likely like staff or somebody that came in, you know, from the outside. I mean, as careful as you are, people in the staff are, you know, and that's what our fisheries are most worried about, too. They're most worried about the people that are coming in, you know, to work from the community than they are from the people living in their bunkhouses, because that's kind of where it's finding its way in, is through people that are,
carriers,
you know, coming in. Yeah. People that live in the community or out in the community, pick it up, bring it into that work. And I'm sure that's how it happened at the Pioneer Homes and these other places, is that as careful as they are, and, you know, as we all know, you can test one day and be, you know, negative and really be positive the next. And so even though they're very vigilant about testing regularly, that somebody can slide through pretty easily, you know.
And you look at it, even with one of our positives, I talked to the person and they tested negative when they left the lower 48, and when they got here, they tested positive. Mm-hmm. And they did everything right, though. And so I will say, I'm not willing to say we've been lucky. In some ways, I agree, we've been lucky. But in many ways, it's the community doing the right thing.
It really is.
And so it's not just a matter of luck. It's a matter of people have been coming, even those who have turned out positive, have been quarantining and doing the right thing, so it hasn't spread to the community. And so it is more than a matter of luck. It's a matter of this community is very fortunate that we have testing so readily available.
We do.
Yes.
We over 9,000 tests, 9,200 and some at this point.
And so, and it's even going to get easier with these $5 tests if they do get widespread, where we can easily access tests at any point. And so it's encouraging. Tests aren't the only thing, though. You still, like I said, this person, as far as they knew, they were negative. And when they left the lower 48, and by the time they got here, they were positive.
The other thing that's really, really hard for people, and I understand completely, is that you cannot test out of quarantine and you cannot test out of isolation.
Right.
You know, and so a positive is a positive, and it may have picked up just that fragment, and the next test doesn't if you test retest, but you cannot, because we know that that incubation period is up to those 2 weeks. So really, you can't test out of quarantine, unfortunately. A lot of people would like that, but that's not an option.
Hmm. This is a follow-up to something we had talked about a little bit at the beginning of last week's show. The question was about the new CDC guidelines that seem to say that testing doesn't necessarily need to be had. The question is, isn't the testing important regardless of whether someone self-quarantines or not, based on results to understand how and under what conditions the disease spreads, so that you can better understand and more efficiently get the pandemic under control?
So here's the thing about that, and they've actually kind of come back and said, well, that's not exactly what we meant. So the thing is like if Shanna was positive and she says, you were my close contact, and I raced right over to Eben and got a test and it was negative. It's negative today, but it probably hasn't even had time to incubate yet, because I was just near her 3 days ago or 2 days ago. And so I haven't even had enough viral load, even if I'm positive. So then I'm thinking, oh, I'm negative. So what they're just trying to say is that you don't have to test everybody, because you still have that 14 days, no matter what, whether you test negative or positive. And a lot of parts of the country, we're fortunate here, we don't have that. A lot of parts of the country, it's really hard to get testing. So people are told they're a contact. they spend 5 hours in a car in Texas and get tested, and then they're negative. And what does that say? Nothing. You're still in quarantine for 2 weeks. So I think that that was kind of the point behind it. Now, even this, so the state of Alaska then came out with a health advisory for providers saying, you know, the CDC said this, and we still think it's great, you know, it's people should get tested if they're a close contact, but they encourage them to wait until about at least a week or 10 days from their last exposure to the person that they were in contact with, because that's a, when about, what is it, Curtis, like 90 some percent of the mm-hmm. tests will be positive. So that they'd encourage people to wait that little bit of time before they get tested. But yes, it's, I mean, it is important that we find, and then because of course they may have some contacts, et cetera. But of course, if they're in quarantine, hopefully they haven't had any contacts either. So that's what came out, but it was very confusing. And the CDC also came out kind of with travel things. But if you notice, they just basically said, we're not going to regulate this. Every state has their own choice. Check your travel where you're going.
So. I agree. The more testing, the better, the more information we have. But when it is a limited resource, it is good to use it wisely and make sure that we do have the testing when we, as we really need it. But I agree overall. I mean, it would be ideal if the more testing that we have, the more testing capability we have, the better. Alaska is one of the four, there's four green or four states that are in the green as far as testing relative to the population and the number of cases that are arising. So we have been really lucky in being able to test a lot more of our population early on. And that does mitigate the, you know, identifies early who is positive. You're going to behave probably differently if you know for sure you're positive rather than just thinking, okay, mm-hmm. maybe I'm positive. Mm-hmm. And then also, you know, we're able to quarantine and keep those cases from spreading. So, I mean, it overall is better that way, but I agree there, you know, it's not practical in the entire country, especially in bigger cities, to test everybody as much as we would like to.
I do sometimes worry about overtesting in the sense that mm-hmm. I'm not sure why we're testing on arrival. Those people should be in quarantine, and I think almost a negative gives them a false sense of, yes. oh, sweet, I'm negative.
Yeah.
I can kind of do what I want. So in the same way, a positive would make them tighten down. I worry that a negative sometimes will give them the idea, freedom to roam now.
Yes.
And that really shouldn't be the case. So I do... I don't fully understand the requirement of a test on arrival.
That was written only because you're supposed to kind of test on, you're supposed to test like around arrival to see if you have it right away. But you're really supposed to be fairly quarantined until that 7 to 10 day.
But my argument is if you're quarantined, why even do that test?
Yeah, you know, I understand. I see that.
I think that it's, you know, probably just a, like kind of what Shanna was saying, which is just that, like, we know that not everybody is going to obey the rules, right? And so, like, if you can catch a few of the positives early, like, it may be worthwhile to do it.
I think it's actually worked out well because we've actually caught a lot of people on arrival. Mm-hmm. I do get worried about the negatives, what kind of message that gives the people coming in.
Definitely agree.
But the positives gives you better ability to go contact trace the people that had just come in that do test positive, even if it's a small percentage.
Gives Elsa a head start.
Yeah,
head start. And like Elsa said,
two of those cases
test...
were this week. So
you can't test out of quarantine. It's a combination of testing and quarantining that's really going to keep the community safe. So you can't really replace quarantine for the test and vice versa. You really need both to see what's going on.
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things, and I think we discussed this last week. I can't remember if it was me or who it was, but like, you know, anytime, like it's like one of the major rules in medicine is that you don't do a test that you wouldn't do anything differently about. Right. So if you're going to do something, if your treatment is going to be the same, then you don't do a test like, you know, in order to, if it's not going to change anything.
Exactly.
And so we have for strep throat is a great example. So like there's this thing called the center criteria where you say, okay, if they have 4 out of 4 symptoms, you don't even need to test them for strep throat. You just treat them like they have strep throat. And so it's kind of has to do with the pretest probability of that being the case. And so if you think somebody, if you have like all the things right, so somebody who's coming in from out of state, we are treating them like they have COVID.
Exactly.
Like we have to treat everybody that's coming in from out of state that has that high risk travel. We're treating them like they do have COVID. They need to take that time to kind of be isolated. And so a test is not going to change that. And so I think that's what the CDC's guidance, what they were trying to do. But I think it was misrepresented or maybe poorly communicated or maybe both.
Yes. Have we, in the course of 4 months or anything, learned anything about the dangers of traveling? You know, everybody is always fearful about the, I'm coming from a hot community, I'm going to an airport, I'm getting on a plane, I'm coming to a new community. What's the possibility there of somebody actually becoming infected on en route here? I mean, is there a lot of community transmission happening at airports and in on planes?
Well, the airline will tell you no one gets sick on their planes. But I think that's because we don't know. I mean, people are coming from hot spots, they're traveling, and then they're coming and, you know, testing a week later positive. So does that mean that they had it when they were in the hot spot, or did they get it on the plane? I mean, we don't know.
I really look at the droplet model, and I think parties, bars, loud singing, those are the places where it tends to happen. Places where there's a lot of noise and you got to shout to be heard. And so you're putting droplets out there. There's not too many people shouting on airplanes. They usually get thrown off the airplane pretty quickly. I think, is it possible that people have gotten it while actually traveling in airports and in airplanes? Yeah, absolutely. I think it's very possible. Is it a big contributor? I don't think so. I would guess that that is not a big contributor to it. It doesn't make sense from the models of transmission that we've seen so far. But we've been caveating everything we say up till now that we don't know. Yeah. But I think it's probably a very low contributor.
That said, several of the Alaska cases were travel related. You know, one of the earliest Fairbanks case, he traveled to Seattle for 24 hours, a doctor's appointment. He was very careful. He made, tried to follow all the rules, wore a mask, went back to Fairbanks, didn't think there was any risk at all of him having COVID from that travel experience. And he was one of the early positives. And then there was a recent case on one of the echoes, maybe a couple of weeks ago, where an EMT from, I think, the Kenai Peninsula area had traveled out, same kind of scenario. They traveled, wore their mask half the flight, took it off, thinking it was a low-risk situation, only saw their family, came back to Kenai and tested positive. So it's hard to know. I mean, they call it kind of the leaky bucket analogy, where the virus is just kind of seeping out around, and we don't exactly know where it is and where it isn't, and you can't see it. So really, I mean, it's hard to say. It's probably not the highest risk, but there is still definitely risk with travel.
I mean, talk about enclosed spaces, like, being in close proximity and closed spaces, I know not all the airlines are, kind of doing the, Alaska Airlines, I think, is doing a nice job of being able to, they're skipping rows and doing, I haven't been on an airplane in a while, but like, I hear that they're doing some things to try and keep people, away from each other. They're obviously mandating masks, which I think is good, but it is an enclosed space and you are in close proximity with quite a few people. So that does come with some risk. And so I don't think we know exactly what that risk is. And there probably are more high risk scenarios that even just pointed out, but, you're in an enclosed space close to a lot of people that you have no idea how careful or not careful they've been, And so I think that does make it a greater risk than what we currently have in our home community, certainly. And so I think it just needs to be taken. Caution needs to be taken.
So each of you, would you travel now?
Well, I haven't traveled since March, and my job is usually 2 weeks in Kodiak, 2 weeks in Anchorage, and I haven't been traveling at all. I don't know if it were something I really needed to travel for and I wore my good mask, then I would, but I would need something I need to do.
Yeah. My problem is there's nothing fun to do right now. It's like I was supposed to be going to Australia in October, but I'm just like,
they won't let you.
They're not going to put up with me going to Australia. And so I'm kind of out of luck. And so, the things I normally travel for is travel for fun. Well, I'm not going to do that when there's so many restrictions. It's not fun. And I travel to conferences. Well, there's no conferences. Right. And so my family's here. And so I'm happy to just, I'm one of those people who loves being, I took a week off for the first time last week in 9 months, and I wanted to be here.
We've been actually kind of struggling with this because my younger brother had a baby in mm-hmm. June, and we've been really wanting to get down there. It's a struggle. It's first of all, like, not wanting to put the baby at risk and those types of things, and then also just realizing that coming back. The other thing that's a reality for I think all of us is that when we come back, we're going to be like have to be out of commission. We're not going to be able to go right back to the clinic and start working, and so we also have to take that in mind, and you have to create like an extra week basically or 2 weeks to just basically allow yourself to quarantine, so that makes it pretty inconvenient to travel as well.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. I've chosen not to travel. I wanted to, my sister had a baby too, and I wanted to go see her and then also just visit family. And so far, exactly, I've made the same decision that it's just not worth it right now, I think, for me and risking other people. And then also, I mean, we'll see about Thanksgiving, Christmas. I would love to go see the family, but I think I'm just going to kind of keep an eye on how things are going in the communities that I might be visiting and also what's going on in Alaska and make a decision based on community spread at that time.
Right. You have to kind of plan for a month, right? I mean,
exactly.
You have exactly. to plan for a month.
2 weeks quarantine, and you can do telemedicine, but it's just you're not back in the same kind of capacity as a physician that you are when you're not just doing telemedicine.
Well, how do you deal with it from the people that are coming in, though? I mean, there are a lot of families. Curtis, you mentioned that you have. Family coming in. I'm not sure if they're coming in from outside or not, but
from Anchorage.
But how does that affect the social relationship you have with the people who are coming in from Minnesota or wherever, and then they're in town?
Yeah. Well, and it's funny. We've actually earlier this week, one of the evenings, we actually had this whole like. The awkward talk, well, what are we doing? I have a brother that's coming in from Anchorage, and, they're on virtual school. So their daughter's in virtual school. They've been doing it from home. And, luckily they've been kind of, both of them have also been kind of working from home a fair amount. And travel in-state is not quite as restricted, although Anchorage has been more of a hotspot, but more recently has been a little bit better. And so I think that we kind of, our two families have kind of talked, and we sort of have an understanding of how we're going to do this. And when they're here, we're going to keep a tight bubble, and we're going to enjoy our time with them, primarily doing outdoorsy type things. But it lends itself to a lot of kind of awkward conversations that you have to have with either family or friends. But I think they're important conversations, because otherwise, if you don't have them, you don't clear the air, then you have maybe one party that feels really uncomfortable with the situation, and maybe the other party feels totally fine with it. It's one of those things. I think that having good conversations that can be awkward, but need to be clarifying into what the expectations are. And so, but it does make, I know that people have, I think people on this show have expressed that they had family members that were going to come into town and decided not to, because it just felt like it was too much. And so I think that there is an element of that. It takes away from the spontaneity and the kind of ability to kind of like just dive into activities with family or friends that are visiting or that you're going to see.
It's kind of a psychological stressor, isn't it, a little bit, when you're having to make a decision based on close family, whether the close family is part of your bubble without going through the protocol, or I think there's a tendency for you to say, oh, they're my family, they'll be fine. And you treat them a little bit different than you would, Uncle George, who's coming in and you don't see very often, know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's tough. My wife did travel, and she was very safe, and it was awkward telling her she had to sleep in the yard for 2 weeks.
It's 3 weeks in, and she's still in the yard, though.
We won't go there.
It is really tough, and my wife sat and I sat down and had this discussion, and we discussed her, frankly, her whole trip and what she did, and trying to make, decisions on how we do the return trip for her. And she did isolate, but I was exposed to her on several occasions. She's tested on arrival and again when she's done with quarantine and she's negative, but there is some risk in having family come, and I understood that. But it's the tough decisions to be made there when you have people coming and going in your lives. And even though we did actually kind of keep our distance for a little while till we had tests, and we still were exposed to one another. And so it's not easy, and it's not easy to tell your parents who have been planning to come here for the last 6 months that, okay, well, you're going to have to stay in the mother-in-law apartment for this week or in the bedroom for this week. It's not an easy conversation to have, and I don't think it's going to happen as often as it probably should, but it's just the reality of being alive.
I got a question about Dr. Zink being concerned about people who are contacted by contact tracers and didn't want to get tested. Is that happening here?
Well, I don't know if it's not wanting to get tested as much as, I mean, some people are, I think that's backwards. So some people are not wanting to get tested. Some people are not wanting to quarantine, you know, unfortunately, especially in other parts of the state. Kodiak has been super great. And, you know, because we were really trying to work together. But in the bigger cities where people are just kind of refusing to or not wanting to share who their contacts are and not wanting to quarantine, not wanting to isolate, you know, and that just makes it hard. It makes it hard when, you know, they tell you they've been someplace with all these people for a whole evening, but they don't want to tell you who or where. So, I mean, we are a free country, which is why we have, like, the biggest numbers of any other country, you know. Our socialized countries have it a little easier in tracking people and making them stay home a little bit.
So this kind of goes a little bit to where what I was thinking earlier when you were talking about the number of tests. If we're testing twice or three times and we've done 9,000 tests, how many 9,000 tests have we done in the community? How many people have we actually tested?
That's a tough one because, yeah. I mean, people like me, I get tested every week.
Yeah.
And so I count towards those numbers. That's one of the requirements we have at Canada is that you get a negative test every single week. So that's a lot of people who are required to be tested. And some people just have symptoms and they've come back multiple times. We've had travelers who come and go multiple times and every time they get checked. There's people like me who've had probably 20 tests. And there's other people who are just frequent travelers who've had 5 or 10. And so it would be tough. I wouldn't even have a guess how many individuals we've tested.
It's hard enough getting our regular numbers. Individuals.
We don't. Do we keep track of
just test numbers.
Well, but I think that's the nature of the beast of testing is, like, you're going to test the people that are higher risk more often. You know, and so, like, I don't think that that's unreasonable. I think those numbers would be hard to get because each of the clinics are doing testing,
yeah.
You know, and so we'd each have to go into it. And some have probably been tested at multiple clinics. And so exactly. It would probably be challenging to get those exact figures.
That kind of skews the numbers that we know about, though. It doesn't really give us a good feel for how many people in the community actually have.
But in some ways, it's a great sample size. You look at it, that's 3/4 of our population. And I realize that it's not 3/4 of our individuals, but we're getting a great sampling of high-risk people exactly. over and over, and a great sampling of low-risk people here and there. And so it's an incredible number to have a population of, what do we decide Kodiak is these days, about 12,000?
Yeah.
And we have about 9,000 tested.
9,223.
That's incredible to me. And so we're very fortunate to have that kind of testing capacity.
Yeah. And people will go in, because I know people in the community do, and look at the state database, and they will see a much lower number of tests for Kodiak. And that is because not everybody is sending all the negatives in at this point. You know, people have just kind of dropped off some of the, you know, it's just really hard to send every negative in and have it counted. And so even though we're counting them in the community, so again, I would say our numbers are more accurate than what you're going to see on the state dashboard.
And we get our numbers from where?
I get our numbers because I harass somebody at all of the clinics every couple days.
So if somebody in the community wanted to look at our local numbers, though.
I believe they have them on the EOC's dashboard.
Okay.
Yeah.
There was a lot of news last week about reinfection, you know, and we didn't have a chance to talk about that last week. Has anybody been following up on those stories of reinfection?
Yeah, there's been several cases in Hong Kong, Belgium, and the Netherlands, and basically they did genetic testing of the virus in the first infection, and then when they reinfected, they genetically looked at the virus again, and it's a completely different virus. So the individual who was tested in Hong Kong had the original kind of Wuhan, January, whatever virus, and then they traveled to Europe, got sick again, and they looked at the genetic makeup of the virus, and it was a coronavirus, COVID-19, or SARS-CoV-2 virus that was more similar to the genetic makeup in Europe. So there is mutation of the coronavirus, and all three reinfections so far have been different COVID-19 viruses. I mean, it's mostly the same, so it's still COVID-19, but there has been some genetic mutation within the virus that makes it kind of look different than the first time. So it is very interesting, and we still don't know about immunity. You know, if you've been infected one time, what is your immunity or your ability to fight off the infection the second time? A couple of the cases, they were sicker the second time around. And how long is it going to last for? We're not sure if it's going to be durable immunity. So there's just, we're still finding out a lot of information regarding what that's going to mean for the population. And if a whole, you know, if New York City goes through a round of coronavirus, you know, when they did, and then another virus basically comes in from, say, some other country that where it's mutated to be a different type of virus, what is that going to mean for that population getting reinfected again? It's still up in the air, but it looks like there's a significant chance for reinfection, similar to the flu, really.
I don't think most virologists would be surprised that this this would necessarily happen. It's frustrating. Like, you wish that it was like, oh yeah, man, you got the immunity, it's great. But like, there's other viruses that I think that it was suspected that as the virus mutated, that we see this with flu and other viruses, that they do mutate, and they maybe you can get reinfected with a different kind of strain in the same sort of virus family. I think it's too early yet to really make a whole lot of conclusions, other than we know that this happens. And, you know, with the flu, one of the things is, even if it's not the exact virus, that like a lot of times it makes it so that it's a less severe case. So we can hope for that, but I don't think we know all the answers to that quite yet.
There has actually been one confirmed reinfection in the U.S. also. Poor young 25-year-old, apparently. Yeah. Those 20 to 30-year-old range, they have a rough time of it. But didn't learn his first time. But he did get reinfected. He did get completely cleared. And I don't think it's been found yet whether the case has come up, whether it's a slight mutation or if it's the exact same one. Even understanding if we do reinfect with the exact same virus, how long is our immunity? We know antibodies wane after 3 months. Mm-hmm. Does the other kind of memory in our immune system is our T cells? Is there enough T cell availability to fight it off? We don't fully know. And that's why it's, you know, we have a lot of questions about an immunization. Is this going to be something that we have to get 3 of and our body's like, okay, I get it now, I understand it, and I'm going to hang on to this? Or is it something that's going to be like a flu shot and we come up with the strains that are floating around that year and you got to get immunized every year or maybe even every 6 months? We don't know. So there's a lot of questions that are going to be answered fairly quickly. There's multiple different, we have 4 front runners for the vaccine right now. And about 1 in 3 vaccines are approved when they reach this phase. So we might get one vaccine out of these four that's a viable one. And even with that, 50% effectiveness would be awesome.
Mm-hmm. 50%?
50% would be an amazing number.
What does that mean? It works on 50% of the people and then 50% it doesn't?
Yep. But it's a really? Way of building up herd immunity. The tough part is when you have a 50% effective vaccine and only 50% of the population is willing to take it, then you're down to 25%, which probably is not enough for herd immunity. It's a tough situation to figure out. When people say they're nervous about taking a vaccine that hasn't been fully tested, I get it. Mm-hmm. I will be taking it. But with this one, I at least understand there's quite a few unknowns. The vaccines that exist now, there really aren't a ton of unknowns. But this one, Curtis and I, we've all discussed it multiple times. The fastest vaccine before this is 4 years, and we're doing this one in about, when it finally comes out, it'll be around a year or year and a half. And so it's very fast tracked.
Just for comparison's sake, the flu virus has been around for a long time, and you constantly are promoting people, go get your flu shot, get your... What percentage of our population does go get an annual flu shot?
I should know that.
I suppose we all should, but I have no idea.
I do know that a lot of Kodiak's really good. I mean, we especially, you know, we had to cut back a couple of years ago to whom we could give vaccines, et cetera, through our first round of budget cuts, which is a long deal. But whole entire families would bring everybody in, grandma, grandpa, the parents, every kid they could round up, you know, and you'd have 10 people coming in all for their, and tons and tons. So, I mean, there are a lot of people that really value it, but then there are a lot who swear they get sick every time. But, you know, usually they're feeling sick already, so they quick go get their flu vaccine, and then yeah. they get sick, and that's, I got it from the vaccine, you know. Because there is no, it's an inactivated virus. You can't get sick from the shot. But
that would be interesting. I have no idea what the rates are. I know that our nurses are very, very busy during the falls doing lots of flu shots on lots of families. And so it seems like our rates are fairly high here, but I don't know what those are.
But you folks are busy every year dealing with the flu. I mean, as I recall, last year wasn't as bad as it was anticipated to be, but the year before was really bad.
I think we have a reason why last year wasn't bad. We were isolating and wearing masks. So it made a marked difference. And the hospital was very quiet when we isolated. There was not much going on. Normally we have COPD people coming in with viral infections who are not doing well. We have people with influenza who aren't doing well. We didn't have any of that.
Yeah. It was pretty remarkable, actually.
It was.
Like, it was like, you know, sometimes we say things and we're like, yeah, is that true? And but it was it was definitely eye-opening for me to, like, just see, like, how many less acute visits, like, in clinic there were. Like, there just wasn't many people that were sick. And, you know, during that lockdown time. Yeah. And I think it's not that I think we should live that way all the time, but, like, it certainly did make a difference in the how much spread of viral illnesses there was in our community.
Yeah, basically since March, when we kind of really locked down, I think we've seen a big decrease. And that's true across the board. The canneries were saying, too, they have had significant decrease in sick cannery workers with upper respiratory infections since COVID-19 mask, you know, universal masking, more distancing measures. So it is really interesting to see how it does affect the population on the bigger scale. And then I looked at the national data for the flu vaccine. I believe it's around 50%. Maybe I think it was like 60 or 70% in kids people who get it in our population. And it is, the flu vaccine is about 50% effective just because there is so much mutation. Viruses are, they mutate so quickly. They're kind of basically not really a life form. They have a strand of RNA that's not really protected by any cellular mechanisms to ensure, you know, the true RNA gets replicated the same way each time, like our body does when we have or RNA or DNA that kind of gets mistranslated. The cells will recognize that that does not accurate, and they basically destroy it so that it doesn't continue to reproduce. Cancer is an exception to that. But viruses, they are just out there replicating as fast as they can, and there's no kind of checks and balances to make sure that genetic strand is reproduced the same way the time before. So they're very...
And its only function is to replicate, is to survive, is to replicate. And so however it can do that, you know. And mutations are primarily one of the main ways where they can...
RNA viruses are the most, kind of the least... stable as far as maintaining how the virus looks each time. So the coronavirus is an RNA virus.
This is a movie, isn't it? my understanding is that flu season, though, starts now, isn't it? Doesn't flu season usually, are we in a later than they are down south? Doesn't it run like September through?
It's usually September, October is when we usually start. Yeah. I mean, and then through the winter, early. Like, I think probably December to March is the very worst.
They usually have a contest between our providers who can diagnose the first case of influenza for the year. It's usually in late October, it seems like.
Then you get the email or the call, like,
you got it, you get a raise.
What do you win, really? Yeah. So we got lucky, though. Lucky, I'm not sure if I should be using that word again, but it was already over pretty much by the time we all started masking up. So you wouldn't normally have flu patients in March, April, May.
We do in Alaska.
Yeah. Well, and this last year we seemed to have a little bit more of a, like, it was a little bit later. It seemed like we had a lot of influenza, because it did seem really abrupt with the close, because we were having quite a bit few cases. Right before the kind of shutdown, at least it felt like that way. Definitely. In the clinic. And then it all of a sudden just like stopped. So it was, like I said, it was one of those really kind of dramatic things to see, kind of clinically, to be like, whoa, all of a sudden. Now, one thing I will say that we probably should come back to is I think people were kind of scared to come in the clinics too. Yeah. So I think there was an element of people are like, oh, I'm not that sick, I'm just going to stay at home. So I think that there was an element to that back in March. I don't think that that's necessarily the case as much now, but for some people, probably. Yeah. But.
Well, I know that some of the early data coming in from down south in the southern hemisphere is that the flu season hasn't really existed.
Exactly.
Because people are so scared of COVID that they're staying away from each other and they're not transmitting the flu.
Exactly. The same precautions that prevent the spread or transmission of COVID also prevent the transmission of flu and other upper respiratory viruses and bacteria as well. So it's working. And yeah, exactly. Like New Zealand, Australia, they're having the lowest flu season that they've had since they've been documenting, I think, illness. So. Mm-hmm.
So that fear that we had that COVID is going to be 10 times worse because when the flu season comes, then you're going to really overwhelm the health center, isn't something that's probably going to pan out here, right?
Well, that all depends on our behaviors, you know. Exactly. That all depends on how are people wearing masks? Are they doing social distancing? Are they washing hands? Are they doing all the things that we're supposed to be doing to try and prevent COVID? Well, help with preventing influenza. And then to put on top of that, if we get immunization rates up, I've been really, really, I'm hoping that our immunization rates for flu are much higher this year because people are kind of wanting to avoid that in the setting of being in a pandemic. And I think that all of our behaviors, the flu immunization, I'm hoping that you're right. I'm hoping that we don't have as much of a rush.
So, from my basic understanding of this being a virus, there's some data that seems to suggest that you can't have two things at one time.
There was about a 2% co-infection rate in China, the early studies of flu and coronavirus. So there is the possibility of it. And there wasn't enough data to show, you know, are people a lot sicker or are they, or how does it, how is their immune system functioning? In a couple of the cases, they saw people were less ill, and they thought, well, maybe since your body is already kind of primed to fight a virus, that those same kind of immune system factors were ready to fight the coronavirus. And so they kind of kept both viruses down at a lower level. But the numbers are so low on that right now that it's not clear what, you know, what exactly happens on that level.
But just knowing from other viruses, you can definitely get infected with more than one virus. I mean, I had a kid up the hospital early last year who, different coronavirus, but two different strains of coronavirus and influenza A at the same time.
And so it's
very possible to get multiple viruses going at the same time, especially in an immature immune system, where you can get multiple things that they've never been exposed to before.
So how do you tell? I mean, when a patient comes in, what kind of symptoms are different between somebody who's exhibiting for influenza than somebody who would have COVID?
I think that's the problem right there, is you can't. Yeah. I mean, it really does take swabbing people to really make a difference. And frankly, COVID mimics so many other things that it makes it an extremely confusing disease. And, you know, I was reading articles on the sequelae from being infected with COVID, what happens after you're done with the virus. And that starts mimicking other diseases and gets very confusing. And so we're going to have a whole segment of medicine that's probably going to specialize in areas on post-COVID syndrome, because this is going to be so widespread and there are some long-lasting effects from this disease. When people only talk about death, it's probably not a good measure, because there's a lot of quality of life. There's people who need lung heart transplants. There's people who need kidney transplants. There's people who are, frankly, who were marathon athletes before the disease and have a tough time walking to their bathroom now. And so there's more to it than simply live or die. There's quality of life factors that have hit a lot of people that's not being measured in the news right now.
There have been some young patients with COVID that had very minimal symptoms of the virus infection that now have long-term heart damage, lung damage, and exactly like what you said, so far, 3 months, 4 months out from having minimal symptoms, their body has not recovered. And I completely agree. It's not just, you know, a lot of people are pushing for having herd immunity and just getting sick and getting it over with, but there is no guarantee that that is what is going to happen for any individual.
So even you're somewhat more of an expert now in testing. Is it?
You know, I am not.
As the recipient.
Yes, he is.
Oh, as receiving tests. Yes, yeah. I've gotten a lot of tests. Doing it, I actually sat down with one of my MAs once, and I'm like, oh, it's warming up. Once you get it warmed up, you're good to go. We can crank them out now. And she's like, no, it warms up for everyone. It really takes 20 minutes every test. I was like, oh, this is awful.
But have we progressed any from March till now?
Yeah, and so we've discussed this before. In March, we had a total of 40 possible tests that we could do in the entire community, with all of the clinics and the hospital putting our resources together. We had the ability to test 40 people total. We do that in less than an hour.
No, I mean, how they do it.
Do it is different, yeah. We were doing nasopharyngeal, which is the sample of your brainstem, where they put a swab so far back in there, you don't think anything should go that far in your head. And that's probably one of the reasons people don't want to get tested ever again. We don't do that now. We do anterior nares, where we're just getting inside where the mucous membranes are, twirled around in each nostril. And that's considered a sufficient sample. I think the hospital does still torture people with the nasopharyngeal swab.
Or a mid-turbinate, so a little bit farther back.
A little yeah. And so I typically do recommend mid-turbinate, where you make it past the anterior nares to get a better sample. But we have progressed significantly. It's a lot easier to do now than when they're having to go way back in to get it done. Mm-hmm. When they told me, you know, I'd had it done previous, and when they told me we were going to do this weekly, I was like, this is not a good idea. it's much easier now, and they frankly have you do it on yourself most of the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's, I mean, when you look at the testing, our PCR is still our gold standard, you know, but we have all the Abbotts and things, which are a little less sensitive. We're looking at this paper testing coming up. The Cepheids are a little more, you know, I mean, there's a lot, there's more capability across the whole span, I think, right now. And then there are some that some of them are have created COVID flu cartridges. So you can do one sample and check for both. So we're moving a long ways, I think, really. The paper testing will probably be a real game changer if that, you know, if that develops. So we'll see where that goes.
And then the $5 test is...
That's what I'm talking about.
That's on the way.
Yep.
Now, isn't that going to kind of skew the data even more, though, if you take the testing out of the hands of the people collecting data? If everybody has access to these tests and are testing themselves, then we don't really know for it. We don't really know how many people have been tested and how many people are positive, right?
Well, the things that I've seen so far, they're still often done by a clinic or by somebody who's monitoring them. Just there's a little bit, you know, going on with it. So I don't know how that'll pan out. We'll just have to see. We already have testing that you can just do online. You know, you can order it, get the test kit, do your sample, send it off, you know, and get your own sample done. So I think the most important thing is that people get tested. It's not like how.
Yeah, I think what you're saying, your concern is valid that there's, but it may capture a segment of society who's like, I'm not going into a clinic to get tested. Right. It may capture a segment of society who just doesn't want the expense of a visit, even though it's free in this town. And so for $5, they can get a home kit and find out. And so we are going to lose some data, but it's probably worth it. It'll probably get people isolating. If they see they're positive, hopefully they do the right thing.
And, you know, I mean, it's if you're doing it a business, you know, you probably your employer would know. If you're doing it at a school, you know, I mean, but how great for, like, school nurses if you know, kiddos come in with a tummy ache. Is it COVID or is it not? You know, I mean, to kind of try and sort those things out. There's a lot of really, really good uses that this could be.
Are we still at the 7-day quarantine, though? I mean, if you have...
14-day.
If 14 days. If a child presents symptoms at school... and goes in to get the test, and then you get the test result back right away, what do you do? Do you send them home, or do you send them back into the school?
So with kids, you know, we've been on this kind of medical advisory just talking with the school. So in Kodiak, if kids come in with symptoms there, you know, that are COVID similar, and we're in a green state where there's very little community transmission, then those kids can go home until they're better, you know, and not actually isolate. But once we get into a place where there's more community transmission, then they do have to have a test. It's just that, you know, especially for kids, they can show things that could be COVID. They'd be out of school all year. I mean, nobody would ever go to school because, you know, colds and stuff. So there's a lot of criteria that's built into that that they've really carefully crafted.
Well, I have 12 more questions here that I didn't get to, and I think we'll have to get to them next week. It's 10 o'clock. So, again, it's always a pleasure to talk to you folks. I'm hoping that we get more questions from people in the community in weeks to come, but I sure have a stack that I could talk with you about for quite a while. So thanks again for coming in and sharing your information with the folks in the community. I know many people very much appreciate what you're doing, that you're taking time out of your days to come in and talk with us. So have a good week. I hope things progress well through the holiday and through the opening of school next week. And good luck to you all.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
All right. Thank you.